Morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It is 9:03. Maybe by tomorrow we can start at 9:00. Present today are Senators Hoffman, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson, Co-Chair Stedman, myself, Chair Bishop. Senator Bonhamoff is watching remotely. Senator Wilson is on another call. And today's agenda, and I'd like to thank our support staff. I can't see Laura. Okay, Laura and Jake, good morning. And SB 132, Controlled Substance Data Exemption for Veterinarians. SB 202, that's a renewable energy grant fund. Removed from today's agenda, just FYI, is SB 81, Village Public Safety Officers. That's due to the amendment deadline that we set yesterday. And we have yet to, that deadline is yet to pass, so that will be forthcoming next week. SB 132, our intention is to hear bill introduction, sectional analysis, invited and public testimony, and have a committee conversation. Senator Holland, Nikki Rose, welcome to the committee. Put yourselves on the record and take us away.
Senator Holland, Alaska State Senate District N. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Stedman, committee members. Thanks for hearing this important bill today. Senate Bill 132. Alaska's 25th legislature created the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, or the PDMP, in 2008. The legislative intent behind the PDMP was to create a database of prescriptions for controlled substances in the state of Alaska. The PDMP may create obstacles for individuals seeking opioids to obtain multiple prescriptions from registered providers and may be a useful tool for doctors in combating the opioid crisis. Under the current statutory framework, Alaska's veterinarians are required to participate in the PDMP, despite the irreconcilable differences between human and veterinary medical practice. PDMPs have been implemented in all 50 states, but 34 other states have recognized the unsuitability of veterinary participation in the PDMP, and they have exempted veterinarians. Senate Bill 132 would add Alaska to that list. The majority of states exempt veterinarians from the PDMP because they've recognized that the PDMPs are designed for use in human medicine, and veterinary exclusion from the PDMPs does not increase risk to the public. Alaska's inclusion of veterinarians in the PDMP has produced no identifiable benefit, yet it has created a multitude of verifiable harms to the veterinary profession and the Alaskans they serve. The PDMP is inappropriate and not effective for use with animal patients, as animals don't have identifiers such as a social security number. And in using the PDMP, veterinarians can view human owners' private health data while treating an animal. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, that protects patient confidentiality does not apply to veterinarians. They are not bound by HIPAA. Alaska has the highest veterinary licensure costs in the United States. Veterinary participation in the PDMP contributes to this unnecessary financial burden on a profession already experiencing extreme staffing shortages and decreasing availability of veterinary services to Alaskans. Also, a recent survey found attempted veterinary doctor shopping across the entire United States is essentially non-existent. Veterinarians are tightly regulated by the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Know Your Customer Act, and the State Licensing Board. Senate Bill 132 seeks to correct an expensive overreach so Alaskans can have access to treatment for their pets without compromising public safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Holland. Ms. Rose, would you want to walk us through a sectional, please?
Good morning. My name is Nikki Rose, and I am a staff for Senator Holland. I'll read the sectional analysis now. An act exempting veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substances Prescription Database, Section 1, AS 17.30.200, relating to the Controlled Substance Prescription Database, is amended by deleting the Board of Veterinarian Examiners from the list of required notification by the Board of Pharmacy when a practitioner registers with the database. Section 2 adds veterinarians to the list of practitioners and not required to comply with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database under AS 17.30 2.200T. Section 3 adds a definition of practitioner to AS 1730.200U. Section 4 repeals AS 898.050A10, which obligates the Board of Veterinarian Examiners to require licensees to register with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Did you have a presentation?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. With your permission, I'll get out of the way of the experts and let them come in here and do their presentation.
Thank you. Please come forward. And Dr. Ward, I guess this would be under the invited testimony. And Dr. Bernhardt, are you guys going to roll us through this?
Good morning. My name, for the record, is Dr. Rachel Bernhardt. I'm before you this morning as the chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners for the state of Alaska. I've been an Alaska veterinarian for, this is my 20th year now, which is very exciting. And I've been involved in everything from dog and cat medicine to marine mammal research to shelter medicine. So I bring a wide variety of experience in my testimony today. And I urge you to support our bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Tracy Ward. My name is Dr. Tracy Ward. I am the veterinarian for Juneau Animal Rescue here in town, and I am the current president of the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association.
Dr. Ward, if you, both of you ladies, can grab them mics, they won't bite, and just pull them right up there.
Thank you.
And as Chair Stedman says, you just bark right into them.
So. Thank you. Dr. Bernhardt and I are here today to speak to Senate Bill 132, an act exempting veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Both my organization, the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association, strongly supports Senate Bill 132, as well as the Alaska Board of Veterinary Examiners and the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. Senator Holland gave a good background on the history of the Controlled Substance Database. We would like to emphasize that veterinarians were included by an amendment for mandatory participation in 2017 that was a blanket amendment requiring participation by all federal drug enforcement agency license holders. Participation involves both querying the system for previous controlled substance prescription histories for a person, as well as reporting new prescriptions that we write into the system. The PDMP, Senator Holland mentioned, it was intended primarily to identify and prevent duplicate prescribing, also known as doctor shopping, where an individual visits multiple facilities or practitioners in order to obtain additional controlled substances for possible misuse. It's important to recognize that the PDMP does not prevent diversion where practitioners such as a doctor or a veterinarian purchases controlled product that is then sold, quote, out the back door to an addict or a dealer, because those drugs are never entered into the system. They're not prescribed. So it is important to recognize that the PDMP is intended primarily to prevent doctor shopping. The PDMP is an ineffective tool for veterinarians, primarily because our patients are animals, not humans. We are not, but we query the system when we go into the PDMP. We are querying our patient's human owner, the person who brought them to the clinic. So we are seeing the human private information as far as controlled prescriptions, and we are not trained in human pharmacology. We do not know appropriate drug choices, appropriate dosing, or appropriate length of treatment period for drugs for humans. So the data that we see, our clients' private controlled substance prescription history, we are not able to interpret whether those previous prescriptions were in fact appropriate or inappropriate, or have the potential for abuse. Correspondingly, when we enter our prescriptions for an animal, that information is not interpretable by our human counterparts, by medical doctors or pharmacists, because they are not trained in appropriate animal prescription, drug choices, doses, or treatment periods either. So essentially, we are viewing data we can't interpret, and we are entering data that our colleagues on the human medical side can't interpret. The fact that we can see private and time-sensitive controlled substance prescription for our clients is of concern to us from a privacy and liability standpoint, because as Senator Holland mentioned, we are not trained in HIPAA, and we do not enjoy patient practitioner privilege with our clients because they are not, in fact, our patients. The fact is that veterinarians present a very low risk for opioid abuse. Data surveys have shown that veterinarians account for approximately 0.3 to 1% of all opioid prescriptions generated in the U.S., across the U.S. and in Alaska. So we're accounting for less than 1% of all the opioid prescriptions that are written by veterinarians. We do not use the opioids of primary concern in the opioid crisis in the drugs that are primarily abused. We do not use OxyContin in veterinary medicine. We do not use Vicodin. We very rarely use fentanyl, and when we use it, it is used in hospital and given directly to the patient, where the owner, the person, does not have access to the drug. In fact, one of the most common opioids that are prescribed and sent home by veterinarians is buprenorphine, which is actually used to treat opioid addicts. The drug has an agonist-antagonist property that makes it of low abuse potential. You don't get a good high from buprenorphine, and it actually blocks opioid receptors and prevents an addict from being able to become high from some of the more abusable drugs like heroin and fentanyl. So we represent a very low risk to the population with the drugs that we prescribe. And as Senator Holland mentioned, over two-thirds of U.S. states have recognized this and have exempted veterinarians from their PDMPs. The result of the PDMP in Alaska has been costly oversight, investigative costs, and business burdens to veterinary practitioners in our state, which Dr. Berngard is going to speak to more in more detail.
Excuse me, doctors. We got three of them at the table, so... I forgot one part of the ground rules before we kicked off, and I'll watch the table. So if you see a hand go up and I miss it, don't stop. We'll stop for questions at the end of each slide so you can keep your train of thought going. So seeing no questions on this slide, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, doctors, for being here. And we had this bill up in Hess, and one of the questions that came up afterwards was dealing with the opioids that are used during surgeries at your facilities. And I had a call from an emergency room physician that had concern upon the amount of break-ins that happen at veterinary clinics. If someone breaks into a clinic and somehow steals some type of opioids, the PDMP does not affect that use. It won't stop that type of break-in, that type of activity. That was a huge concern from some emergency room doctors. So I just want to get that on the record and get that question asked.
Sorry, so your question is that affecting the PDMP?
Yeah, would the PDMP stop someone from breaking into your facility and taking drugs from your Pyxis-type machine?
No, of course it would not. That's similar to the diversion situation where the PDMP is only about drugs that are prescribed. So it would not. I should add as well that we are required by the Drug Enforcement Agency to have all controlled substances under double lock and key, either in a double locked safe, particularly for that purpose, or in a single lock safe that is behind a locked door. So the break-in and steal possibility, in my clinic, for example, we have a gun safe that weighs about 600 pounds. Behind a door that is locked with a code. So even the possibility of someone being able to break in and get those drugs is very low. But if it were to happen, the PDMP has no bearing on that situation.
Thank you.
So just if I could follow up with Senator Wilson's question, and I'm not being flippant, Senator, but Am I missing something? Is there a lot of smash and grabs going on with veterinarian clinics in the state? Because I haven't read of anything in the paper.
Not that I am aware of. I was speaking to the possibility. Mm-hmm. Certainly, since the onset of the opioid crisis, I can't speak to many years previously, but since I have been in Alaska, most practices keep very minimal amounts of these drugs on site for specifically the use that Senator Wilson was discussing for use during surgery and the immediate post-operative period. They're rarely dispensed. If we have to, most practices would write a prescription and send someone to a pharmacy in order to prescribe these drugs. So there's minimal amounts kept on site. They are kept under double lock and key.
Thank you. Please, seeing no further questions, please continue.
Thank you. So for the record, my name is Rachel Berngart, and I'm the chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners. So you guys have heard from Senator Holland that there is costly oversight that comes along with veterinary participation in the PDMP. So speaking as the chair of the Veterinary Board, our board has seen investigative costs rise exponentially since 2017. Now, we cannot say that all of the investigative costs for all monies accounted for are due to PDMP. What I can say, though, is that we have seen typically maybe 6 or so, maybe 10 cases where somebody is perhaps alleging veterinary negligence, something completely unrelated to the PDMP. And those investigative costs have remained approximately about the same. Where we do see an increase in investigations are referrals from the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. And just to be clear, these referrals from the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program are not alleging that veterinarians are engaging in any nefarious activity. These are simply alleged violations of veterinarians' inability to use an unusable system. Like Dr. Ward has already talked about, animals don't come with social security numbers, they don't come with birth dates. There was initially a lot of confusion as far as who to query. Is it the owner of record? Is it the house sitter who's bringing in the dog? Those sorts of things. So just to be clear, while we have had a massive increase in investigations due to the PDMP, not one single incident of veterinary doctor shopping, nor veterinary, we'll say, poor practice behavior has been identified. So these are technical violations within a system that technically doesn't work for veterinarians. And this is having an actual cost to veterinarians. As I'm sure you're all aware, the Board of Veterinary Examiners is a self-supported board, so we don't receive funding from you fine folks. We are supported solely by the license fees of veterinarians and veterinary technicians. One other thing that I would like to just get on the record is that there is grant money out there available for PDMP costs and administrations. But it is important to understand that those grants cover the PDMP side of the investigation. So the PDMP folks flagging violations, compiling that data, sending that over to investigations. But as soon as it hits the investigation side, the Board of Veterinary Examiners has to pay those investigators. So while there is grant money available for PDMP, it's only on the PDMP side of this. It's not available for the veterinary board to utilize to pay investigations. And as you've heard, veterinarians who want to participate in Alaska currently enjoy the highest licensing fee in the country.
Seeing no questions, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talk about the business burdens that are placed on veterinarians, it's important to understand that veterinarians may delegate the task of querying and reporting in the PDMP, but they may only delegate to another licensee, which is, in our case, a veterinary technician. Just for numbers references, we have about 430 some odd licensed veterinarians in the state of Alaska. We have about 270 licensed veterinary technicians in the state of Alaska. So when we think about that, we've got a lot more veterinarians than we have technicians. So our ability to even delegate is extremely limited. So what does this mean? This means that veterinarians are spending time querying and reporting, which increase, it takes time to do this. This is, our systems do not integrate with the PDMP system. So when things take longer, costs go up, and the cost to the clients go up. So we're talking about not only cost in money dollars, but we're also talking about cost in time. If you're doing one thing, that necessarily comes at the expense of doing something else. And as you've heard, we already have a veterinary shortage in Alaska. So when we think about veterinarians having to dedicate time and resources to utilizing the PDMP without any identifiable benefit, we can say for demonstration purposes that there is absolutely been identifiable harm, such as increased cost to clients, decreased cost or decrease amount of veterinary time to actually be doing what we're trained to do, which is provide veterinary care.
Doctor, I got a question.
Then please.
Then Senator Wilson has a question, but I'll yield to the table. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions that have come up after our hearing was that could it be possible, or I guess it's a question, could it be possible for veterinarians to use human pharmacies to get their meds, their pet meds that may be in terms of opiates, so that there's still that PDMP tracking, but the, you just shift that burden on to local pharmacists. And I only know of one retail pharmacist that only has three locations in the state that can do that. I didn't know if that was a possibility or if that's a option.
So through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Wilson. That is, it is absolutely a possibility that veterinarians would use outside pharmacies to essentially dispense the medication. As the statute is currently written, it's the act of prescribing, so the act of either physically writing out the prescription, handing it to a client, or calling in that prescription over the phone that's requiring us to query and report.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Doctor, how many veterinarians is Alaska short now? What's the gap?
Thank you for the question, Chair. That is a wonderful question, and I cannot say for certainty what our need is. I can say that a fairly large percentage of veterinarians who are in fact licensed in Alaska do not actually live and practice regularly in Alaska. We do have, and it's not a requirement to be an Alaska resident to be licensed in Alaska. We have many veterinarians who are licensees who live elsewhere. They come up to practice to do relief work, surgery specialty services, those sorts of things. I can say just from, so I've been in Juneau for 19 years now. We used to have about 12 doctors, and in Juneau right now, we are currently down to four practicing doctors at clinics open to the public, and we now are graced to have Dr. Ward practicing at our Humane Society. So there has been a massive decrease of veterinarians, as well as, and Alaska is not the only state suffering veterinary shortages. This is a nationwide problem right now. The pandemic pets definitely didn't help that situation. A lot of people acquired pets are seeking veterinary care. Wait lists around the nation are weeks to months to get into a veterinarian.
Just a quick follow-up. So there's no analytical evidence that of your shortage, that your association hasn't went out and done any hard science on the number of shortages of veterinarians. I was just curious if the PDMP was an impediment for new vets coming into the state, and if there's any evidence of these states that have repealed the PDMP requirement, if we're seeing stronger numbers, if you will, maybe not as much as a shortage. So you don't have to answer that. That's just, I mean, it's just a question for me.
Through the chair, I can speak to that. I don't think there's hard evidence that the PDMP is an impediment in and of itself. And as a reasonably recent, I came to Alaska 5 years ago. I don't think I would have I didn't delve into the details of taking a job here to the extent that I would have said I'm not moving to a state where I'm still required to participate in the PDMP. I think the point that Dr. Berngar was making that about the shortage of veterinarians, it's more about if we want the veterinarians who are here practicing to be able to make the most efficient use of their time and be able to treat as many patients as possible, because we know there are wait lists in almost every practice in the state for new clients, that's where the impediment is coming from, that we're wasting time we could be spending directly treating patients.
Thank you for that answer. Next slide.
And Chair, if I may, just to complement what Dr. Ward said, The other side of this is not only retention of Alaskan veterinarians, but it's recruitment of new graduates. When you look at the debt-to-income ratio of veterinarians, unfortunately, that is upside down. When you get out of medical school, you usually enjoy a high salary to complement your high student loans. In veterinary medicine, you do not necessarily enjoy a high salary that complements your high student loan burden. So when we think about what the initial cost of licensing is to a veterinarian, and that may or may not be paid by the veterinary clinic that veterinarian is wishing to associate with, those costs, and combined with the cost of living in Alaska, et cetera, those are things that new graduates that I've spoken to have voiced to me, that they are considering. You know, when you're trying to make ends meet and when you have a high licensing cost right out of the gate, that is something that is affecting potential recruitment.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So this committee has heard now about how veterinarians are monitored by the Drug Enforcement Act. I'll run through this slide fairly quickly. All veterinary practices are required to participate in the suspicious order monitoring system, which means essentially, as a doctor with a practice, you need to tell your veterinary drug distributor what types of patients you see, how many of those patients do you see, what your ordering expectations are for that year. Any deviation from that expectation triggers that veterinary distribution company to contact the Drug Enforcement Agency. So veterinarians, one question that we've gotten a lot is, hey, if you're not participating in the PDMP, well, who's watching over? And the DEA is. Dr. Ward already alluded to some of the physical requirements for keeping drugs. We also have to maintain daily meticulous records for any drug that we use that is a controlled substance down to the tenth of a milliliter, which is essentially a drop. So those records must be available to be produced at any time for the Drug Enforcement Agency, as well as kept on record for the past 7 years. And those, every drop of medication is accounted for by client name, pet name, the date, what the procedure was, and how much. And then so we know what it exactly, down to the tenth of a milliliter, what is in our safe behind those double locks. And with that, I will conclude that essentially it makes sense to exempt veterinarians from the PDMP. We've shown you today that it is an ineffective tool for veterinarians to use. It also creates ineffectiveness on the side of our human health counterparts with the commingling of veterinary and human data. We've alluded to our privacy issues, we've discussed costly oversight, the business burdens, and the low opioid risk that veterinary prescriptions pose. So with that, I will close, and I'm happy to take questions from the committee.
Senator Olson, did you have a question, sir?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for coming in this morning and testifying in front of this committee. I've got a number of questions, and I guess we'll start off with, do all veterinarians have a DEA number?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, no, not all veterinarians do. So it is only the veterinarians who have a DEA number that are required to participate in the prescription drug monitoring program currently.
Okay. And how often do veterinarians prescribe Schedule 2 and 3 drugs? I mean, you talked about no oxycodone, but there's oxycodone and Vicodin and a number of other things, but there are other drugs that are within the Schedule 2 and 3 that are there.
So through the chair to Senator Olson, I think that that's a broad question when you ask how often. I think it really does depend on the type of practice. So if, say, you are a veterinarian who performs solely emergency practice and you're seeing the hit by cars, the stomped by mooses, those sorts of injuries and urgent needs, that practice is going to have a very different opiate usage output, so to speak, than somebody who maybe does house calls and does wellness checks and health certificates, or somebody that does farm calls and works with horses and cows, where opiate use in those animals would cause major health concerns for those animals, and those types of drugs are not even appropriate for use. So I think it's a pretty broad question as far as trying to answer it to the best of my abilities. So if you have a follow-up, I'm happy to.
I'd be glad to. Let's put it more in perspective. When was the last time you prescribed a Schedule 2 or 3 drug?
Well, so I'm probably not the best person to ask. I have also recently graduated law school in May of 2020, so I'm not in full-time practice. So for me, it's probably been since 2019. However, Dr. Ward may be a better person to ask. She's currently involved in active practice.
Dr. Ward, when was the last time?
Through the chair, I prescribed a controlled substance last week.
Not a controlled substance. I'm talking about Schedule 2 and 3 drugs.
Schedule 2s. I would have used it within the last week, but within the clinic.
And that's pretty much
and that standard, is exempt.
Standard for all vets throughout the state?
It's I can't speak to standard because different types of practice would use less frequently. The practice that I work at, we rarely we do not dispense at all. Any prescribed substances would be sent through a pharmacy. Probably the most common one that we would send home would, as I said, be buprenorphine for 2 or 3 days, and that probably happens a couple times a week. Probably more than that, probably daily, nearly daily. And then something like hydrocodone for cough suppression probably happens out of my practice once every week or two.
If I can continue, Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
You talked about the high license fees that licensees have to go ahead and pay, and usually since it's a self-funded program for the investigations, is that reflective of how many disciplinary investigations have happened over the last recent past that has driven that cost up?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, that is certainly the board's impression. Mm-hmm. We have a very, and I participate in national conferences of other veterinary state boards, and as a whole, Alaska enjoys veterinarians that practice high-quality medicine. We have a pretty low level of complaints generally. So I can say that it's not as though we've seen an increase in people alleging negligence or those sorts of issues with practice. What we have seen is it's a significant increase. And just for example, we usually have maybe six to 12 open investigations. We've had upwards of 50 open investigations, and that difference is made up by PDMP technical violations. And each time one of those violations is sent over, investigations has to investigate. That's what they're directed to do. So it's not as though we can just look at it and say, well, you know, it's probably just a technical violation. We're not really going to look at that. They have to do their job, and that job comes at a cost to our board.
And does the vet board have their own investigator?
We do not have our own investigator. We share investigators with other boards.
And going back to the shortage of veterinarians here in the state of Alaska, does Alaska have reciprocity with other licensed veterinarians?
So through the chair to Senator Olson.
Ma'am, just for the record, I'm sorry. Each time, because we have two female voices, make sure you put your name back on the record. Sorry for not.
Sure. Thank you. So for the record, this is Dr. Rachel Berngart through the chair to Senator Olson. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has a veterinary program. The veterinary students, they do their first 2 years at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then they do their clinical years, so the second 2 years, at Colorado State University. How many of those veterinarians come back to the state of Alaska is hard to say. I don't have that information. UAF may have that information. But as far as reciprocity with other states, I don't know if we used to, but now that we now that we have essentially our own program, I would speculate that if we did, we probably do not now.
And I guess the most concerning question that I have to ask this morning has to do, and it's related to this bill. Are you familiar with some of the disciplinary actions that have dealt with controlled substances and the disciplinary action that's happened? Because there was a veterinarian in my district who was taking the medicine himself, apparently, and disciplinary action was done. Now, that was a number of years ago, but it certainly was something that was on our horizon, or on my horizon, as a holder of a DEA license myself. It was one of those things that's very troubling.
So, through the chair, again, for the record, this is Dr. Rachel Berngart to Senator Olson. So I am aware of, and I'll just, not to bring up any specifics, but I am aware of probably the same scenario. I've been on the board since 2016, so it seems about the same time frame. One thing that is very important to remember is that the PDMP is one tool in the toolbox. So opiate addiction, opiate overdose, opiate death is a huge problem, and there are many tools in the toolbox that the state of Alaska is employing to try to bring those numbers down. The PDMP is one of those tools. So, for instance, if you have a doctor who is impaired, that doctor is not entering that into the prescription drug monitoring program. That doctor may be, you know, and we could talk about all the other ways that the prescription drug monitoring program doesn't catch, we'll say, bad actor doctors. Or impaired doctors. If there is a doctor who is getting medication illicitly from overseas and selling it out the back door, the PDMP isn't going to catch that. If there's a doctor who's purchasing additional medication from a distributor trying to sell it out the back door, that's where the suspicious order monitoring program comes into play. But so to say that it's the veterinary participation in the PDMP would have helped in that situation, that would be an incorrect statement, because that is drugs that would have never gotten entered into the PDMP. They're not prescribed drugs.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
You finished, sir?
No further questions.
Thank you. I just have one. why are not all vets enrolled with the DEA? Is it because they don't prescribe these drugs that are required by the DEA? Was that it?
So, for the record, my name is Dr. Rachel Berngart to the chair. So veterinary practice looks like a lot of different things for a lot of different veterinarians. We had, you may have all met Dr. Sarah Coburn. She is an assistant state veterinarian. She's not in practice, so there's no need for her to prescribe those medications, but she is a licensed veterinarian and she's involved in biosecurity. There are veterinarians we have a specialty pathologist in the state. She only works with dead animals. There is no need for her to have a DEA license. She's not prescribing at all. So it's different types of practices that account for how some veterinarians need DEA licenses and some don't.
Thank you. Further questions from committee before we go to public testimony? Senator Wilson.
I do, Mr. Chair, but I think it's for the Department of Commerce and Development and Economic. I can never say that. DEC.
Do you want Ms. Chambers to come up?
I do.
Ladies, doctors, thank you. And I, as one member of the committee, want to thank you for what you do for Alaska's pets.
Thank you for your time.
Ms. Chambers, you've been summoned by Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers, for coming. My question is just to get a clarification on the PDMP in terms of how that works in terms of veterinarians and catching bad actors. The PDMP sends out report cards to any practicing individual that enters the data, but those report cards are not reviewed, correct, by any law enforcement agency, anyone that would catch an outlier. Is that correct?
Thank you. For the record, Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. And through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's correct. There are a variety of reporting metrics that the PDMP utilizes, and the prescriber report card is a tool to help the prescriber see when they themselves are sort of an outlying prescriber. So there is an outlying prescriber module that that we are working on with the software vendor to fine-tune, so there could be greater oversight by the boards. But the report card that's received takes various metrics into concern and is just educational for that prescriber. And that kind of points back to the original legislative intent, is that this would be an educational tool for prescribers to change, to gain awareness and change their prescribing habits when it comes to opioids.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chambers, as you represent the department, if this bill were to pass, would it have an effect on the high license fee that's been noted with the department?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, thank you for that question. Many members of the committee have heard us talk about licensing fees in the past and know that it's a fairly complex analysis that we perform. This board, as was specified earlier by Chair Dr. Berngart, this board has seen a dramatic uptick in investigative costs directly related to the PDMP because there has been some confusion among veterinarians about whether they're required to register or not. And so there has been a compliance problem, and as she mentioned, we're duty bound to look into those things. However, that's really just been one fairly isolated incident. I think that if the veterinarians were to continue in the PDMP, we will see more, particularly if the legislature opts to keep veterinarians in the PDMP but not change PDMP laws, we will continue to have confusion and frustration on the part of veterinarians, which will lead to investigative cost. Now, the fees are high because every fee in Alaska, we're the best at everything from domestic violence to eating ice cream in Alaska. We are number one because of our economy of scale. So per capita, we do things more expensively here. And Alaska is required to have the same legal, investigative, administrative oversight as every other state, and every license fee is the highest in the country because of that, not because of the PDMP. But even though this program received $10,000 in UGF last year and is slated to receive $250,000 in UGF this year to offset fees, which is a shameless plug for our budget request, their license fees will likely continue to increase as a result of these investigations. So there would be, to sum up, I know I added a lot of value to that answer, to sum up, if they were to be taken out of the PDMP, it's likely their fees would increase at a lower rate. So there would be a financial benefit to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Is the department supportive of the bill?
Through the chair, the administration hasn't taken a position on the bill per se. The department has, in all things, taken a position that we're bound to follow the law. So we are pursuing enforcement and application of the PDMP as the legislature dictates. So we haven't taken a position, but we certainly see all sides of the arguments for and against.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
As a person who saw the PDMP come to fruition and having to deal with its guidelines, I'm fully in support of this bill because of the extra burden that we all have that are, you know, as we get older, we want to be less busy, not more busy with paperwork. And so I'm in support of this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Seeing no further, Senator Wilikowski, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Have there been complaints about opioid abuse or drug abuse in any of the investigations?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there have not been any substantiated issues with veterinarians that would have been related to the PDMP. So we've had a lot of complaints of noncompliance, and we have not had complaints of any veterinarian misdoing or wrongdoing as a result from the PDMP.
Okay, seeing no further questions, that concludes our invited testimony. Now we're going to open public testimony. And I believe, looking at Jake, but I believe we've got a Dr. James Deckler in Soldotna that's on for public testimony.
Hello?
Dr. Deckler, if you could put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Hi, my name is Dr. Jim Delker. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the chairs and the committee. My wife and I have been practicing veterinary medicine for over 25 years, and I've owned a private practice here in Soldotna for 19 of those. I've served as an unpaid volunteer on our Alaska Veterinary Medical Association board since 2010. We are a small group of 160 veterinarians or so, and as such, we have no paid lobbyists. I've personally been involved with the veterinary PDMP issue since it first came to our board's attention in 2013. We as a veterinary organization had identified numerous problems with the PDMP, and we attempted to share those concerns with the PDMP staff and the Board of Pharmacy. Yet here we are over 8 years later, and nearly all of the issues we presented back then are still present and somewhat problematic within the PDMP today. As we saw in testimony today, there's not been a single case of doctor shopping or diversion through a veterinarian identified by the PDMP within the past 5 years. Yet still, within the recent past, the Board of Veterinary Examiners spent well over $60,000 on investigations of around 56 veterinarians, with essentially all the investigations being related to PDMP noncompliance, not opioid diversion or abuse. So the cost of this program to both taxpayers and veterinarians is both excessive and unwarranted, especially when you consider the amount generated by the roughly 300 veterinary licensees who basically sign up for the PDMP that would generate around $8,000 in revenue, and we've spent well over $100,000 in administrative and investigative costs in just the past few years. I would like to comment a little bit on the shortage of veterinarians in the state. That has been kind of a topic. I recently hired a veterinarian. It took me over 2.5 years to fill this position. In my community alone, there are two other clinics that have lost two veterinarians, and the other one lost one, and then the one in Homer has lost one as well, too. So they are all trying and seeking. I've been looking for over 2 years to find a veterinarian and have not been able to fill that. So there is definitely a shortage of veterinarians within our state. The other thing about the licensing costs is that the cost to license part-time and relief vets, many of whom decide to return and stay in our state, it's becoming a deterrent for recruiting new doctors to Alaska. And adding to that shortage is the shortage of licensed veterinary technicians. I have 6 doctors and 8 support staff, and only one of them is a certified technician. So for anyone to say that we have ample numbers of licensed veterinary technicians in the state would be a detachment from reality at this point. I would like to also touch on as far as the types of medications that we dispense. In 25 years of practice, I have never prescribed Oxycontin, Vicodin, Methadone. The types of medications that are controlled that I prescribe or dispense are drugs like phenobarbital, which is a seizure medication that has low abuse potential. And so the types of medications that veterinarians in general prescribe are not typically the ones that are high abuse potential. So at the present time, 34 other states have exempted veterinarians from their PDMP programs. We're not asking you to follow the crowd for the sake of following, but with a bit of research, you will find they exempted veterinarians for the same reasons we are trying to share with you today. We as veterinarians are happy to support efforts to truly decrease the opioid epidemic, but we ask you to please make our efforts result in measurable benefits. If you put aside the emotion and consider the facts, I think you will come to the same conclusion that the Board of Pharmacy did recently and give support to our bills.
Thank you. And if you're, can you wrap up, please?
I think that concludes, unless there are questions, I think that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. All right. Is anybody else online for public testimony? Jake, I don't see anybody else. Public testimony is closed. Senator Olson.
Can I ask Dr. Deckler a question?
Dr. Deckler, are you still there? Sorry. Can you see if you can get
it? Yes, I'm here.
Dr. Olson has a question.
Dr. Deckler, you talked about not prescribing some of the medication that you talked about, Vicodin or whatever else. What do you use for an antitussive when you're dealing with an animal?
It kind of depends. I typically start with over-the-counters with something that's equivalent to Robitussin or things like that. if the case progresses or it's not responding to another product we have that's called Temeril P, then I will occasionally use hydrocodone, which is a cough suppressant, a liquid form cough suppressant. So, but that I can't recall the last time I described or prescribed hydrocodone.
Follow up, Mr. Sherman.
Follow up, Senator Olson.
Do you ever go to the extreme of using codeine?
I don't believe that I ever have that I recall in my practice in 25 years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any other committee discussion before
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank Dr. Decker for coming back.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thanks, Dr. Decker, again. And seeing no further committee discussion, amendment deadline Monday, March 21st at 12 p.m. We'll set this bill aside and go to Senate Bill 202. So take a brief at ease while we change out presenters. Okay, we're back on the record. Bill 202. Are we done here?
Yeah, we're done.
Okay, we're back on the record. Senate Bill 202. This is the first hearing. Our intention is to hear bill introduction, sectional analysis, take public testimony. Senator Rivak.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop and Co-Chair Stedman, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, Senator Rivak, District M. SB 202 extends the authorization of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and Recommendation Program, setting a new sunset date of June 30th. It simply extends the program for 10 years. The Renewable Energy Fund, or REF as we'll refer to it as, is a program was originally established in 2008 with the passage of House Bill 152 and later received a 10-year extension in 2012. In both cases, receiving a unanimous vote in the legislature. The REF is managed by the Alaska Energy Authority in coordination with the 9-member Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee. The program has an open application process and are currently in round 14. Each submission is considered by its economic and technical feasibility. The AEA's recommendations are sent to the advisory committee, and their final recommendations are then sent to the legislature for approval. 39 applications were received during the last round. Since its inception, the Renewable Energy Fund has distributed $275 million in grants for qualifying and competitively selected renewable energy projects across the state. $34 million has been directed at projects on the road belt and $248 million to projects in rural Alaska. SB 202 amends the 2008 session law as amended in 2012 to extend the sunset date to June 30, 2033. The bill also sets an immediate effective date. This has a $1.4 million fiscal note for maintenance of the fund, financial services, and oversight of existing and new grants. This amount reflects what was budgeted for in fiscal year 2023. These REF grants have been supplemented by both federal and local funding to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. These combined funds help to stabilize and reduce energy costs for consumers by supporting renewable energy projects in both urban and rural communities across Alaska. As energy prices climb, I think it's important for Alaska to take advantage of all of our available sources of energy and heat, especially in our most energy vulnerable communities. The Renewable Energy Grant Fund is an important tool which supports Alaskan communities to alleviate the high cost of fuel and meet their energy needs. And thank you all very much for hearing this bill. I'm happy to take questions. We have Mr. Curtis Thayer from the AEA online to answer them, and I believe a presentation was distributed to all the members of the Finance Committee. And lastly, I'll just say that because of this program, 30 million gallons of diesel have been saved since 2008. With that, Mr. Chairman, again, Curtis Thayer is online, and I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm generally supportive of this program. I've sat on the I'm currently sitting on the Renewable Energy Advisory Committee along with the other senator across from me, Senator Von Imhoff, and I'm generally supportive of this program and the process that they how they choose their funds. So I'm thanks this good senator for bringing this up for renewal.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Wilson. Seeing no other comments, we're going to go to public testimony. Opening public testimony, and looks like we have Mr. Jerry Medina from Inside Passage Electric Cooperative in Juneau. Mr. Medina, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Two minutes, please.
My name is Jerry Medina, and I'm the administrative officer for Inside Passage Electric Cooperative. I'm testifying today in support of SB 202, extending the date of the Renewable Energy Fund. IPEC has received two construction grants from the REF. In 2015, IPEC completed the Gardena Falls Hydro Project in Hoonah. The REF grant amount was $6,694,000, and the remainder was financed through a low-interest loan of $3 million to complete the project for a total project cost of $9,694,000. Since August 2015, when the project came online, the fuel saved to date is 542,711 gallons of diesel, resulting in a savings of $1,297,979. Hydro generation from Gardena Falls to date is 7,910,266 kilowatt hours. IPEC also received a grant from the REF in the amount of $3,920,000. And we also received a grant from RUS for $3 million for construction of the Gunnett Creek Hydro and Cake. A low-interest loan of $1,840,000 was secured to complete the project for a total cost of $8,760,000. This project was completed in October 2020, and since then it has saved 70,833 gallons of diesel fuel, for a savings of $165,350. Hydro generation today from Gunnett Creek is 1,003,122 kilowatt hours. There have been several days in Cape from 100% hydro generation where diesel generators have been off. Total diesel fuel saved for both projects to date is 613,544 gallons, resulting in a cost savings to our customers of $1,463,329. As you can see, the Renewable Energy Fund has been instrumental in completing two successful clean renewable energy projects for IPEC customers. And we also have skin in the game for both projects. The success of Gardena Falls and Gunnett Creek would not have been possible without the REF. And this concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there are several ways of measuring this this program, one of which is fuel saved. Clearly, that's pretty obvious. I'd like to know what the meter rate is to the communities of Cake and the communities of Hoonah when these hydro generations were turned on, and if that meter rate cost to the citizens went down or up.
Thank you for the question. So IPEC has a postage stamp rate, so all four of our service areas pay the same rate. So the reduction or fuel savings is reflected in the COPA, which is the fuel surcharge. And currently our COPA is just over 15 cents per kilowatt hour. And so as fuel prices go down, the COPA goes down. As fuel prices go up, the COPA goes up. And our latest invoice from the barge you know, we were down to just over $3. Now it's $4.22 a gallon. So even though we have, so hopefully we have a significant wet year and the hydros will generate as much as possible and we can get that COPA down. But as you know, fuel prices are rising and that's certainly not helpful.
Follow up, Senator Stedman?
Mr. Chairman, my concern is as we do these projects, and my understanding with the community of Cake that the meter rate actually went up, not down.
That's incorrect. I don't know where you're getting your information from.
Okay, well, you could get back to the committee on that because that came from the community itself, the community leaders themselves in their meetings with me, including City Hall. So if you could get back to the committee and give us some historical rates to the communities, because the concern is as we try to move away from diesel and go on to renewable energy, that we, you know, don't lose sight of the goal of moving our rates down, not up. So I'll wait for your response back to the Finance Committee on the rates charged to the citizens that you serve.
If I may, Mr. Senator, you know, as I said, all customers pay the same amount, so the customers in Hoonah, if that was correct, if the price went up, the customers in Hoonah should also be telling you that their prices increased. So that's false information that you're getting because all our customers pay the same rate. All our customers benefit from the hydro.
Please provide the committee as per the request of Co-Chair Stedman. Thank you. Next up is we got Michael Rovito, Deputy Director of Alaska Power Association in Anchorage. And if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Rovito, and I am the Deputy Director of Alaska Power Association, or APA. APA is a statewide trade association for electric utilities in Alaska, and our members provide power throughout the state. APA is in full support of SB 202 and of extending the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, and we strongly urge passage of the bill this session. We would also like to thank Senator Rivak for sponsoring this legislation. Many of APA's electric utility members have received crucial funding from the Renewable Energy Fund since its inception. These funds have supported the addition of renewable energy projects that have lowered reliance on diesel fuel, stabilized rates, and decreased the carbon footprint of electric generation. As you heard a little earlier, there have been 244 Renewable Energy Fund grants totaling $275 million, and over 95 operating projects have been built using Renewable Energy Fund funds, saving more than 30 million gallons of diesel each year. The Renewable Energy Fund is an extremely valuable program that has proven itself as worthy of continued operation. There are also numerous projects under consideration for future rounds of grant funding from the Renewable Energy Fund. These projects, as past projects have, will be chosen through a deliberative process run by the Alaska Energy Authority and reviewed by the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee. By extending the sunset date of the program, electric utilities in Alaska will have certainty that the Renewable Energy Fund will be there as they continue innovating the power systems of the state. Thank you again, and this concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Jomo Stewart, Fairbanks. 2 minutes, sir.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we
Thank
can
you,
hear
sir.
You.
All right. My name is Jomo Stewart, and I'm the President and CEO of the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. And I just wanted to just very quickly lend our support to the extension of the Renewable Energy Grant Program. We've long supported the program and any state efforts to help communities and individuals diversify their energy base and hopefully drive down their energy costs. Here at FEDC, of course, a lot of our work is regarding energy, and again, that attempt to diversify the energy mix here in the community and also, again, drive down costs. It would be nice if, as a complement to this, some funds might be found to help reactivate the home energy retrofit and rebate program that used to be operated by AHFC, because that takes it down from community to actual home scale. But again, at a minimum, again, keeping that, this program active so that the benefits of diversified energy suites can be enjoyed by residents would be a good thing. So thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Jomo. And we're looking into your last suggestion. Started that 2 weeks ago. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay.
Yep. Seeing no further public testimony, public testimony is closed and the brief at ease. We're back on the record. Mr. Thayer, are you with us still?
Yes. What can I do for you, sir?
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Curtis, do you have a sense of what the percent of successful projects is versus, say, abandoned projects that are funded?
To the chair, Senator Wilikowski. We currently have 99 operational, and we have 38 in development. So, and we had 244, so a little less than 100 have not gone forward. Part of that is the economics of the project itself, or the future funding for the cost of the project. We have a few projects that are looking for additional funding, primarily through the infrastructure bill or other means. And so just because a project hasn't moved forward, some of it is the cost of it. One thing that's important to note is this is a lot of feasibility work. And so in order for a project to move forward, we have to have the feasibility done. And this is what that fund helps do, in addition to move projects along. And earlier in the program itself, more funding was available in the sense that you could get $6 million or more for renewable energy projects, and right now it's capped at $1 million. So that's one of the challenges that we have going forward.
Follow up?
So of the 100 that have not gone forward, do you have a sense of what percent have been abandoned versus what percent are still in development?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can sure look that up and pull that, because we do have, and I can send to the committee a complete list of all projects and their status.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And follow up?
Yeah, and I I'm just trying to get a sense. I mean, it's obviously been overall a very successful program and one that I continue to support. I just want to get a sense if there's something maybe that we could do a little bit better if we've got projects that we've invested in that have not gone forward. Slightly different question. Well, actually, very different question, Mr. Chair. Are these funds sweepable?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, these projects are usually spent in which they're already encumbered. When we first, like round 13, which we did just in August, that $4.75 million, we've already encumbered those funds and moved those projects out, and currently we're on round 14 and have approximately $15 million if the legislature approves the funding for it, and we have 39 communities that are subscribed to that for $19.2 million. There will be some that will be disqualified based on economics or on technical viability, but right now we usually don't have any money left in the fund to sweep. and so it has not been swept in the past, is because from the time we get to, we move a project forward and it's legislative approval, we usually are putting encumbering that money literally within a few months.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
So the answer, Mr. Thayer, is that those funds indeed are sweepable if there is a balance left in the fund.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe that would be correct. We have not had any sweep just because we've not had money in the fund. Just to put it in perspective, round 14 is this year, round 13, but round 10 and 11 and 12, there was no funding by the legislature for the program. And so we did have $4.7 million last year, and we're asking for $15 million this year for the program. So there hasn't been money in the fund to sweep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further comments.
Seeing no further questions, public testimony, I think, is closed again. And we're going to set this bill aside.
Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that this is a great program. The largest benefit, I think, is that those grantees that are funded under the hydro or under wind, they get their rates stabilized, which is, I think, the most beneficial part of this program. Those that are on diesel today can see their rates in the last few years even double. Energy costs continue to be probably the largest expenditure of individuals in rural Alaska, whether they spend it on heating or on electricity or on motor fuel expenditures. So I'm greatly supportive of this program because it does stabilize individual rates, and those that benefit from them, their lives are greatly improved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. I echo your comments. So, Senator Rivak, did you have any closing comments before we set the bill aside?
No, Mr. Chairman, just thank you. We appreciate you hearing this bill.
I'd like to thank our testifiers today that called in, and we're going to set this bill aside. Tomorrow, this afternoon at 1 o'clock, SB 111, Alaska Reads Act, and intervention. And or other bills previously heard or scheduled. With that, we're adjourned at 10:15.